I think that the Guajira and the blues have a strong common bond. They're both the result of working people, those who cut sugarcane in Cuba or Puerto Rico, or who have picked cotton in the south of the United States. Music, after all, reflects the people. And it's the most beautiful when it comes from the people. Summertime, and the living is easy. Fish are jumping pretty, baby, and the cotton is high. Your daddy's rich, your daddy's rich. Your ma, she's good looking. Hush, pretty baby, don't you cry. Amada prenda querida, no puedo vivir sin verte. Amada prenda querida, corazón, no puedo vivir sin verte. Porque mi fin es quererte y amarte toda la vida. I'd like to bring Mr. Adam Coker, Michael Mossman, Hector Martignon, and a little jazz and Guajira, the two worlds I love.
Your feet are just moving. Your heart is glad. Hello, hello, hello. That's master percussionist and conguero Ray Barreto, who has performed in the jazz and, of course, Latin world for so many years with his own Summertime, featuring, of course, Ray Barreto on congas, Adam Coker on sax, Philip Michael Mossman on trombone, Hector Martignon on piano, Jairo Moreno on bass, and Vince Chirico on drums, combining Guajira and blues. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, September the 24th, and it is open forum. This is where you get to select one issue from the 500 million that we experienced in the last week, including and up to today. You pick one that grinds your gears the most, and then you firmly plant yourself on your soapbox and persuade us all with your unmatched ability to unmask both offender and offense. But be warned, you know, we've upped the ante here on analysis and debate, so we're expecting to see evidence of considered opinions, and of course we want you to at least cite one thing that you can't disagree with on the other side. But then, of course, you come at it with a straight razor and you slash it to smithereens. Be merciless. Your counteroffensive. Well, so many things have happened, and of course, we go on air today just as the president concluded his 45-minute address to the United Nations, acting like he was in charge over there too. Oh my gosh, you know, it is very, I think it's a lost cause trying to persuade heads of state of the United States to recognize that they're not the world. You know, we are a country in the world community of countries. And you don't, even though you think, of course, you are the boss of the empire, you don't convey to people, heads of state and their top-level delegates, that essentially you're in charge. You could tell them what to do. And, of course, it's not lost on anybody sitting there in the General Assembly today that even as the president, of course, tells the assembled body what to do and what not to do, he is currently heading a government that may, in a matter of a week, be shut down. You know, that may or may not have a budget, an operating budget. And that in both houses of this great democratic government in the United States, they haven't been able to take care of business here. But there he is, our man, Barack Obama, standing regally, looking down on the minions and telling them today what they ought to not do and what the United States will countenance and what it will not countenance. On the plus side, he did seem to suggest that, well, they're at least disposed to taking another tact, that is, moving back a bit from war and trying diplomacy, trying really hard at diplomacy first. So that was an interesting little hint. But what was curious was in the aftermath of it all, when you listen to some of the analyses being offered on the news, you get that, you know, that chorus of we. So what should we do? What are we doing? You know, the pronoun is overused as if the journalists themselves are the stand-ins for the diplomatic corps. It's really a fascinating thing how arrogance actually is democratized in the United States. Everybody has a version of it when they are in positions of leadership or power or influence. And it would be useful. It probably might be futile, but it's useful to for them to entertain every now and then the idea that they need to examine their language, to be very careful that, you know, you do an analysis, which is great, but you must distinguish between what it is you're thinking and what it is you think we ought to be thinking. The most valuable piece of real estate, ladies and gentlemen, is between your ears, and everybody's fighting for it. Well, the phones are open at 888-874-4888. Let's get involved in some really serious debate today. I want to know what you're thinking, and you really need to have a serious opinion. Let's see. Who's up first? We have Harvey from Berkeley. How did I know that? Hello, Harvey. How are you?
Very good, and how are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Well, I'd like to talk about what I consider one of the most serious problems is the preservation of our freshwater resources here in America and the world. And the four horsemen of the, first I'll define the problem, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, that's nuclear, coal, methane, that's natural gas, and nuclear, They've created the perfect storm, especially here in California. They've released a lot of CO2. They've released a tremendous amount of CO2 into the atmosphere, which is diminishing the snow caps on our mountains, thereby reducing our freshwater resource. And at the same time, the melting of the polar caps, which is creating ocean rise and intrusion of our salt water into our freshwater aquifers. And the second point is that the fracking...
Hold a second, Harvey.
Yes.
I'm going to ask, who are the they who are doing all of these things? And where are you getting your information, your facts from?
I'm getting information from information that I've read and studied for 20 years now a variety of sources every day, including all the newspapers, the media, and that oil, natural gas, nuclear, and coal are the main ones responsible for the massive release of CO2. And so by heating up the world, they are diminishing the freshwater resources. And at the same time, the frackers, when they're fracked for natural gas and oil, they're poisoning the groundwater. There's been many, many articles to state that. And thirdly, with so what we've done is on the West Coast, we've built all these desalination plants to draw water out of the ocean. And now there's a plume coming from Fukushima, a radioactive plume that's going to hit the West Coast just as many of these desal plants come online. No, I don't believe these desal plants can take out the radioactivity out of the ocean water. So I think that this is the perfect storm. And the first thing that I believe we have to do is turn to solar energy, because solar panels, once manufactured, use no water over the lifetime, 20 to 30 years of their life. So that's the key. If we want to preserve our freshwater resources, we have to get star-powered. We have to get solar, and that's the point I want to make. It's all about the water.
Well, you salvaged your point of view quite well. Thanks.
Thank you.
Great start. Thank you so much. 888-874-4888. From Dallas, the one, the only, the inimitable, Sarah.
Greetings to you, Utrecht.
Hello, how are you?
Utrecht, I am great, and greetings to Harvey out there in Berkeley, and I was so glad that he mentioned that, because we know the next war that's going to be fought is going to be the water over water, because water is every living being is going to need that water. And as he said, with the pollution that's going on, which is one of the things that is going on in Syria, what this fight is over, it's over the water, more so the water than the oil that's going on over there. But I'm digressing. This president and this United States, Utrecht, and the addressing of the UN Security Council, and my personal take...
Oh, it's the General Assembly, actually.
The General Assembly, excuse me. The General Assembly. My take is this. These General Assembly's meetings need to be rotated. It should not be in New York every year where the UN headquarters is located, because the United States do most of the funding for the UN. Therefore, she has a very heavy hand in dictating policies, in twisting the arms of the other five members on the National Security Council to getting her way.
But a president. Well, so how did the United States become a she?
Well, I just refer to it as a she because of the many people on here.
Especially when you're coming up with all these bad things here. You can say it.
No, I'm not blaming the female gender. I'm just saying because of the multiple of people on here, I'm going to refer to this as a she because we all know that men can't do it all by themselves. So we
Lord have mercy.
We're going to start gender wars now, so please bear with me, fellas. they need to rotate it, because every year everyone packed their bags and head to New York. If the people in the United States and the other six member council, they don't like them, they didn't like Libya, they didn't like Venezuela, they didn't like Iran, they're going to block them on Cuba and tell them, no, you can't come. We're going to play. This is my ball. You're not on the team. You're not welcome to come over here and say what you have to say.
Can't do that, because the United Nations actually is diplomatic ground. Everybody associated with the United Nations, no matter what their leanings and no matter the current relationship between the United States and such nations, they're entitled to be there.
Yeah, they're entitled to be there, Utrecht. But we know that every year they go to, because I was reading where the president of Northern Sudan, he was debating whether or not he wanted to make that trip because he has a bounty on his head to go before the Hague. They have that on his head. So they are doing arm twisting because he know with the way how the United States and they're snatching up people, heads of states, and dragging them off to jail and all on to the Hague and everything else, he's taking a serious risk if he leaves the African continent to venture far because it could possibly happen because you're living in very uncertain times now where heads of state is subject to be criminalized and be picked up and be taken in black ops operation and be dragged away to who knows where. But with the president and what he is saying with Iran, and they have to dismantle their nuclear power with Syria and they need to give up their weapons, no one is mentioning but what Israel needs to do. The United States is not talking about what she needs to, or it needs to do in order to get rid of its weapons. It's always so-called the people that it make into the face of the public enemy, they need to get rid of theirs. People have a right to protect themselves as a sovereign nation in order to protect their borders. If they want to have nuclear weapons as a means or any type of weapons as their means of their protection, they have a right to have their means. Nobody's coming over here and telling the United States, all these stockpiles that you have, you need to start dismantling. You need to start getting rid of yours. Israel, you need to do the same with yours because you have been the major factor of disunity on that continent. Ever since Israel has been there, there have been nothing but turmoil has been going on in that part of the world from the African continent to Asia. It has been a source of a thorn in everyone's side. But no one is telling them that they need to dismantle this. It's always about everybody has to give up what they have and sit around like a sitting duck and wait to be attacked while the United States is running around here with its sense of its exceptionalism. Oh, we are so exceptional because we are the world police. We are so great. You're so great, but look at what you're doing. You're about to cut the SNAP program. You're about to tell people that, okay, if you want to get some benefits, you have to subject yourself to drug testing, get yourself a job, and all these other nonsense that you can't even fund the continuing resolution is subject to go offline by the end of the month. And all of these things, you're calling yourself exceptional. You can't even take care of your own people at home, but you want to run around the globe and try and tell everybody it's what they need to do in their house.
So let me see if we could course or map your discussion today.
Yes, ma'am.
So we started out with, do you remember how you started this?
Yes, ma'am. I covered many grounds. I started off with a water war.
You admitted you digressed, and we agree.
Ma'am.
You digressed, so we forgave you your digression.
Yes,
but then
ma'am.
You came back, and then what was your theme?
My theme was the United States, the UN.
Right. The UN needs to be rotated. All right.
Yes.
So we got that argument. And then
ma'am.
You deftly left that, and you hurtled over the boundary to something else.
And then I went over with the president addressing, telling these nations to dismantle their weapons.
All right. So basically, you broke several rules, but all is forgiven.
Yes, ma'am. I do apologize. But to get back to rule number one, Utrice, and what you were saying, to stick to the one topic, is my thing is that all these nations need to go around. They said, you know what, we in all these meetings, we need to rotate it. No, we don't need to always come to New York and do these meetings. There are many countries that are represented here. Each one of these countries need to have a chance to host these meetings every year.
Quiet as it's kept, that is a huge expense to many countries to just hold a meeting because it's not about just people sitting down in one place. The immense cost of security,
mm-hmm.
and of course accommodations and so forth. Security is a huge issue,
and
many countries simply don't want to, burden themselves with that cost or with that responsibility. The world is
taking that into effect. Yes, Utrice, but what they should do is places like China, Japan,
Canada,
change the venue. For those who can afford to host it, give them that opportunity like they do with the Olympics. They have a bidding process. Give them that opportunity to host these meetings rather than coming to New York every year because we already know the Biden.
But there's another cost. I mean, there's another issue, and that is the ancillary costs of moving the meeting from New York, no matter who hosts such a meeting. you'd find that it would pay very well for their local economies whenever these meetings occur. Mm-hmm. It's a real boon to the local economy. So, but I understand your point. The thing, though, is the recognition, and this is you, I mean, when you looked at the way the president conducted himself today, and these are, you know, on a high level, a high diplomatic level, you don't get the sense from the president that he understands what protocol is. For example, you acknowledge the Secretary General. It would be a good thing. And the language used in the world of diplomacy is to be tempered. Mm-hmm. That does not mean that you in any way, you know, water down your position. But when you say something like, it is an insult to human reason and to the legitimacy of this institution to suggest that anyone other than the regime carried out this attack, and that comes from a head of state, that is directly aimed at the Secretary General, who was the person who, you know, within his capacity and his authority, authorized the investigative team, which came back with a report that did not state who fired this. Right. So when you behave this way,
it's a bully.
It actually is. It's a kind of thuggery that the United States has never really been able to relieve itself of, and to observe good diplomatic relationships with other agents, other countries. And that's why they fall back. They don't want to, you know, that kind of thuggish behavior, although it, you know, it looks nice in a nice Italian cut suit and a blue tie and all of that. But the world of diplomacy, our president seems, his speechwriter, I should say, too, his speechwriter appears not to understand the need for statesmanlike behavior. This is not the way you behave as a head of state. You do not insult the Secretary General. You do not insult those listening to you and lord yourself above everybody else. It is these are the things that typically, that have typified, I should say, the United States and its conduct. And it is an alienating thing. You don't have to go there. You don't have to behave like some kind of a monster or beast to get your point across.
High-handed, you treat, mm-hmm. which is as I said earlier, is between the United States. Even if the speechwriters put that together, you treat, I'm sure he did a chance to run through it. He did a review of it.
Of course, yeah.
So he should have tweaked it himself to say, you know what, I need to take this out, because if Ban Ki-moon, who is supposed to be the Secretary General of the UN, which really he's a puppet, Carla Ponte, the lady who went in and did the investigation, who said she came back, and she said it was the rebels who were the ones who had done it. That's what she had said in our initial investigation. Now, all of a sudden, you're going to be throwing water in these people's face and make it seem that, okay, because you're paying the majority of the funding for the UN, that they need to do whatever it is that you want them to do, even if it means telling a lie? That's in essence what he's saying.
Well, the point I'm making is that this is behavior unbecoming. Our president has done this repeatedly. His speechwriters, who are evidently culturally deprived, have no idea how you speak to people, especially when you're speaking as the head of state. Mm-hmm. There are heads of state who would deliver blistering comments, and it wouldn't sound anything like it. But you know, it's couched in diplomatic parlance, the way they're accustomed to talking to each other. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be lost in the sauce what the president thinks. But when you start saying things and you flinging accusations, when you tell somebody it is an insult to human reason, you're saying to the Secretary General, you know, you must take us for idiots. You're insulting us, and it's not that at all. But thanks, Sarah, for calling.
Yes, ma'am. Why you insulted the man?
Well, not insulted him. He insulted everybody, because everybody there is representing a nation. That, you know, you don't come before a group of nations, allegedly as a member of this world body, and you start behaving like, you know, the gangster who just came to town, and you're blasting away, you know. That stuff, that kind of thuggery, people have great distaste about it. It just is not the way you talk. And this particular president, whoever is writing his speeches, clearly has no idea how in different venues you tailor your message so that you are not even in the slightest misconstrued as being insulting to your audience. But we see when the president goes before the graduating class at Morehouse College, he behaves just abominably. He goes in the mall at the feet of Lincoln, behaves abominably. This speech is insulting. You go all over the place like that, and it's the one theme. You're here to insult people and you know, stomp around like the big dog in town. Thanks, Sarah, for calling. Thanks so much. 888-874-4888 is your number to call. What's on your mind? Tell me what you think. Well, I have this on my email. What we must do is to first mind our business, stop drawing nitwit red lines, and then forgetting who the hell drew the damn line in the first place. We need to go home and shut up. Nobody in the Middle East is a threat to the United States. For thousands of years, the people of the Middle East have solved their own problems without us, and that is just fine with me, says Steve Kruger. Well, thank you for that. He's participating on the leadstories@gmail.com. I find this thing really, it burns me up. It burns me up the way this president behaves and the speeches, and I don't know who clears the speeches or who thinks it's a great idea to speak to people in an international setting this way. But it wasn't just against the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon that the president behaved this way. He, you know, this business of wagging the finger, all those days are gone. They're so out of it. Those days are long gone. People are not terrified of the United States anymore. You know, they would like to feel that the United States has reached a point of maturity in the way it deals with other nations. They would like to see evidence that the United States is not has had a firm handle on its international thug reputation. They'd like to see a certain level of refinement and an understanding that the world would be a far better place if people came to a discussion prepared to accept the right of all nations to assemble as a group without this idea that one group, one person, one country is the exception to the rule. And when it comes to the party, everything has got to stop. The band has got to play its tune, you know, that kind of thing. The proverbial skinny guy on the beach kicking sand in people's faces. Or the muscled guy, I should say, kicking sand in people's faces. Those days are long gone. That's very ugly behavior, extremely ugly behavior. And this president has not shown in the 5 years that he's been in office, he's not shown that he has understood how one conducts oneself as a head of state, what you say and how you say it, how you advance the cause of your country by muted behavior. Nobody's ever going to suggest that they don't understand the power of the United States. They get it. But you don't have to come in there so loud and nasty and, you know, all that guff. It just turns me off right away. It turns me off completely. And even so, you know, as Sarah correctly said, things are not all that rosy here. And the domestic issues being experienced by the people of the United States would pretty much convince anybody from looking at us from the outside that the president doesn't have a handle on what's going on in his country. But he's busy telling people what they ought, what the other countries ought to do. I mean, I'm chuckling because it is so, it's not because it's so funny, but because it's so ironic. We'll take this little break and come back to your calls at 888-874-4888. This is your time. Use it well. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we are in open forum today. And, of course, that means your views are the views of the day. You get to guide the conversation. I'm here just directing traffic. That's what my job is today. When we have open forum, I direct traffic. That's all I'm supposed to do. But it is your thoughts, your ideas, your opinions that are important today. Of course, they're important every day. But today, you have greater room to express yourselves and to bring to our attention the issues and events you think warrant further inspection and discussion and debate. So do that at 888-874-4888. Last week, I did introduce an idea about what do we call the state of affairs in Syria. And there's a particular reason for that. If you have some thoughts about it, we did get such a thought. If you do have some ideas about that, let me know. What do we call what is happening, the state of affairs in Syria today? Some people are saying it's a civil war. Some people are saying other things. But what do you say? And why is it important? Why is that question important? Nobody really got that yet. I got some feedback, but I think we have a way to go to explain why that question is important. So I'll wait to hear if anybody gets it today. What is the situation in Syria to be called? And why is the question important, if you have any ideas? I just received a reaction again via email from Livia, who says, I did not hear the speech, but I know one thing. I suppose she's referring to the speech by the president to the General Assembly this morning. When you start to disrespect people and try to make everyone think you are the top dog, it just shows your status is on the decline. This I know better and I'm better attitude with other countries and its own citizens since day one. I think this government should do more listening. Well said. Of course, in an international setting, you know, it's like anything else. It's a beauty contest, of course, a huge political beauty contest, and people would be swaggering back and forth. But, you know, we should really insist that our heads of state, our representatives, be schooled in proper decorum. They really need to understand how you speak to nations so that you, in turn, can be respected. Clark from New Jersey, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Clark.
Recently, I've been looking at some stuff going on the internet, so I took a chance and looked it up and did a little reading. There's a comment article saying that the Bureau of Justice Assistance, I guess part of the FBI, Justice Department, sent a memo to local police agencies saying that to be on the lookout for local homegrown terrorists, I guess, and they had certain characteristics. Some of the characteristics were if the people express viewpoints such as our foreign policy being the cause of some of the problems in the Middle East. And if these people express sentiments saying that there's more to 9/11 than the accepted government version. So I'm kind of confused because my question is, if I was to say that I think that perhaps some of our allies in the Middle East, such as Saudi Arabia, were funding our enemies of al-Qaeda and al-Nusra, and that now I guess our enemies are becoming our allies, would that make me a terrorist?
Interesting question. Let's see, could you rephrase that so somebody could answer it?
Well, you know, I wish somebody could answer it, so I would probably need help to rephrase it.
Oh, that's good. That's real good. You're basically asking, is a friend of your enemy also an enemy or a friend?
And then if I talk about that, do I go on a terrorist watch list or something because I ask that question? Now, this is what they have requested our law enforcement agencies to be on the lookout for. And I would say to my law enforcement agencies, what about this third building that came down on 9/11? No one ever talks about that. So would that fall under something that they should look at instead of thinking about the things that I'm saying also?
But you know, Clark, I'm going to use a lawyer's tactic with you. Mm-hmm. I strongly suspect that you asked a question already having an answer. So could you give us a piece of the answer from to the question that you yourself just asked?
You got me. I can't do that. Because I'm really, as a citizen, I'm kind of really, you know, hesitant now about everything.
You shouldn't be. I mean, countries, again, all governments lie. Okay? Just accept that. All governments, every single one of them, lies. They all lie. And many of them lie and convince themselves that it is the better thing to do because the truth, people can't, you know, to swipe that quote, people can't handle the truth. And sometimes we can't handle the truth because it's so dreadful, it's so nasty, and it's so clearly linked. You know, just the way the president just said, it's an insult to human reason. It's an insult to human reason that some countries could actually tell people these things with the expectation that they ought to believe them. So all governments lie. The matter is that in international affairs, we find that people are less likely to become involved in, you know, calling their governments, their respective governments, to accountability because they're more concerned with domestic issues. They're more concerned with what's happening within the borders of the country rather than outside it. You know, when cases become really flagrant, like the Vietnam War and other atrocities that governments are involved in, the people do speak out. But it is more often the case that they ignore government or they tolerate government misbehavior abroad. The United States, it's clear, in the situation right now in Syria, is aiding al-Qaeda. It has pretty much recognized that. Many members of Congress are asking the same question that you're asking. How do we say, how do we categorize Al-Qaeda as a terrorist government that we are supposed to be annihilating, but we are arming?
Prepaying, yes.
Right, so it doesn't make sense. But these are the kinds of hypocrisies and inconsistencies of government. That's what happens. They could live with these kinds of contradictions all day long. You know, today we told Japan at one time was our enemy. No, it's not. China was the enemy. No, it's not. You know, this is the way it works. For some, it is a schizophrenic way of behaving, but that's the nature of how countries, especially in our world today, that's how they behave. They, as psychopaths and sociopaths, having absolutely no remorse about the contradictions and about their actions, having no remorse about it. I mean, the president stood up and told people, look, yes, we use drones, and it's because it's more efficient. There were no boots on the ground. No, the boots were in the air, in the drones, and in the planes, and the fighter bomber, you know, that kind of thing. But when the government says these things, it actually is convinced that the schizophrenic nature of its thinking and actions are quite normal. It is the people who are out of whack.
Well, I appreciate that.
You're on the right track because you've noticed the contradiction, which means you're healthy.
Well,
you're an astute person.
But it's hard to say anything now unless the administration really clarifies that, because that stops really independent free thought. And I guess to me, it kind of says that, as Bush said, if you're not with us, you're against us, but that means you have to be an accessory to the crime. And everybody's not crooked. So, you know, that's what bothers me, because if all these things are so evident, you know, how come the people that we pay to handle the government to represent us internally and to the world don't really at least say, look, we're guilty, we did it, we're sorry, we won't do it again, or something like that. But still, to me, it's really bad that these question marks just continue ad infinitum, not being addressed, and expecting to go away like the elephant in the room. It's just like a wound that never heals.
Astute at picking up these inconsistencies and contradictions, and it shows that you are healthy.
You're
very healthy, and stay that way. This from someone describing herself as disgusted in New Jersey. It is extremely distressing that President Obama is behaving just like a neocon. We thought nothing could be worse than the Cheney-Rumsfeld-Bush tantrums. Shameful and embarrassing stuff. How did we get here? Even though Mr. Obama's record was not terribly hopeful before his first election, there was that glimmer of hope. He was not one of those horrific, ignorant, war-barren neocons, says disgusted in New Jersey. Wow. Hello, you're on the air, DX from LA.
Yes, hello, Eutrice. How are you?
Hello,
today?
Fine, thank you.
Good, good. I had something I wanted to bring to people's attention and see what they kind of think about it, but first I wanted to answer your question about the Syria thing. From what I see here, it's like two warring factions, one stronger than the other. You might say like mafia or gang wars, like the Bananos versus the, you know, Gambinos, or the Bloods versus the Crips, or something like that, because they're both totally corrupt and evil and all these things. And the fact that we're backing Al-Qaeda side of it is just so ridiculous beyond words. So that's what I would describe it as, just a gang warfare going on to see who's going to have the power. And they're both very unscrupulous and very evil.
All right, but let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. There may be two groups, like the Bloods and the Crips, or like the mobs, you know. However, one of those groups is elected.
Right.
Okay.
Well, so they say. I don't know.
It's an elected group.
Yeah,
one is elected, and one, and all of the others, because you know there are several others. One of them is elected. So now what do you have?
Well, elected is a subjective term, irrelevant.
Fine, we understand. Just like the United States, you know, we had elections here where the outcome was in doubt, but they closed their eyes and said, well, we'll go with this decision. So it's good. All right, but so even so, let's put it the way it is. So you say it's mob warfare, but one of the mobs is elected.
Quote-unquote elected. Yeah.
So now what do you have?
Well, you have the same thing, only one of them is better at either twisting people's arms to support them or pretending to be something that they're not before they're elected, or however it came out. I don't know the particulars of their election, but, I mean, it's like going on one side of town and trying to ask people, oh, well, you know, Mr. Gambino says this and says that and says that, and so do you agree or not? And if you're in his territory, you better agree. You see what I'm saying? So it just depends. It just depends. You know, I mean,
no, it doesn't depend. I mean, this is a serious question. Why am I saying that the question is serious? More serious than we give it shrift for.
Well, it is a serious question, but...
But
I'm
why?
Saying that, well, because there's lives involved. Deaths, lives, and all these other things. But what I'm saying is the question of whether somebody's elected or not becomes a moot point when you look at what's actually occurring here is people are dying, so it wouldn't matter if they were elected or a straight-up dictator that just took power. And by the way, I think that's what the rebels are trying to do, just overthrow and take power. It's the one gang against another. That's all I'm saying. You know?
All right. But we still have it that one gang, at least, you know, by nominal standards, is elected.
Right.
An elected head of state. So do we have just gang warfare, or is this something else? Now, they're saying this is a civil war.
Right.
But in a civil war, do you have a civil war when one party is the elected government and the others are seeking to unseat the party? Is that a civil war?
That occurred in this country, didn't it? I mean, there was a civil war over...
Yeah.
Whether the federal government was going to have power over they say this is what it was about, over the southern states. And so these people, right. So, I mean, that's a civil war, obviously, but I mean, other than, well, see, it's two factions just trying to either maintain power or gain power. That's what I'm saying.
We understand all of that, but I'm saying we have a situation, however illegal the election was, or however, you know, unqualified the elected government is, whatever. But we have an elected government, and we have all kinds of factions seeking to unseat that elected government. Do we have a civil war? Is this a civil war? Is this an insurrection? Is this a revolution? What do you call this?
I wouldn't call it a revolution, and that's just my opinion. But I do believe you could describe it in a few ways. It can be more than one thing at once, in other words, on different levels. But I do believe at heart this is exactly what I described in the beginning. It's two factions trying to either take power or maintain power.
We get that. I'm asking, really, the question is being asked to elicit a definition by international standards
by international.
As to what exactly is this to be called, because depending on what you call it,
right,
it would then give an entirely different view as to how any country or any individual or any organized group gets involved. In other words, there are rules that apply even in warfare. So you have to be real clear about what it's called. Now, you would notice how the United States hasn't called what happened in Egypt a coup.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Why? Why is it? Because it was clear that they are avoiding that term, because then it proscribes them, it prohibits the United States from becoming involved in a particular way in the internal workings of another country.
Right.
Now, the reason I'm asking, because nobody has actually said, I mean, we use the term loosely to call it a civil war and whatnot, and then I got to thinking, oh, wait a minute, I'm repeating what everybody else has said, but if we really look at it, is this a civil war? When you have an elected government, however rigged it was.
Right.
You have an elected government being attacked now from within, and being many of those groups being supported by outside agents like the United States and France and whoever else wants to get involved. So we have not understood yet, what do we call what's going on in Syria?
Well, to me, I don't know enough. Well, my personal opinion, I don't know enough about this election, quote unquote, to say whether this is a real legitimate government or not. And then also, these people that are fighting against Mr. Assad's forces, we do know what kind of people they are, though. We've heard a lot of things coming out. Now, we've also heard about some things Mr. Assad's regime has done, too. So that's why I'm saying they're both corrupt.
Don't say what he has done. But what I'm saying is, put yourself in this place, okay? You're a crooked guy, whatever it is. You're semi-crooked, crooked, totally crooked, whatever. On the scale of crookedness, you appear somewhere there. However, you've managed to pull off, in the eyes of your country and the world, you're elected. You're an elected, just like, you know, when George Bush got elected, and the big debacle about the vote in Florida, everybody said, well, all right, but let's forget that and just keep on moving. Now,
right.
The process of election aside, because however it is, it appeared to have satisfied certain internationally accepted precepts of democratic election. Okay? So you have an elected head of state. You have an elected head of state. Whether the process was good, bad, or indifferent, we're just going with the flat theory of it here.
Right. So you're trying to pin me down on whether I think this is it.
I'm just trying to figure out, what do we call it? And I have had this discussion with several people, and they said, you know, well, what do we call this?
Right. Well, one thing I know it is, I'll call it a mess.
Mm-hmm. We know, but the question is being asked to satisfy the internationally accepted definition of what it is, because what it is by international law then defines how and if any individuals or groups or nations, it will strictly define the limits of their involvement, because the involvement also could be legal or illegal.
Right. But
right.
Given the fact that given the fact that the only country in the world who has its finger on the trigger, ready to pull it, is the United States, I think that it matters what they're going to call it, the United States government.
Well, it hasn't called it anything except that we are going to bomb it. But we'll talk about this as we go ahead. Thank you so much, DX, for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you all. And let's meet here again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Thank you so much for your participation today.
Along with Jairo Moreno on bass.